Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
It's good to see everybody this morning. We are continuing our study this morning on the life of Peter. We're calling the study Simon Says, the given name of Peter. We are on the third lesson, and if you've got a bulletin this morning, on the back side of that bulletin is a handout for the lesson. The lesson that we're going to cover comes specifically from Matthew 14, from the reading that you heard Ricky give us this morning. And Ricky helped us set the context. He said that this comes immediately after the feeding of the 5,000, which is correct. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. But if you look at the bottom of that handout, we've got the text beginning in verse 22. But we'll talk a little bit about the story that leads into that, which is the feeding of the 5,000. Before we get there, I want to just, I've been trying, if you've noticed, to integrate with this study of Peter some of what we covered in the Holy Land lessons on Sunday night, a few months ago, because going through the life of Peter, we are in largely in the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, which is where Jesus had his ministry. And it gives us an opportunity to go back and revisit some of those places that we looked at in our Holy Land series and help not just, we talked about the geography, but now to give some context, where do these things actually occur? So the two things, the main story we're going to look at this morning is Jesus walking on the water and Peter asking to come and join him on the water. That's why we call this lesson the cruise, because this is dealing with the apostles in a boat on the Sea of Galilee and seeing Jesus walking on the water. And as Ricky said, just prior to that, we have the feeding of the 5,000. By the way, the feeding of the 5,000 is one of those few stories in Scripture that is in all four Gospels. I've mentioned several times already in this study how we refer to Matthew, Mark, and Luke as the synoptic Gospels because they tend to have the same narratives in all three of those, and so they're referred to as the synoptic Gospels. John is a little bit different, but the feeding of the 5,000 is in all four, and the story of the walking on the of Jesus walking on the water is in Matthew and Mark and John, but not Luke. So it's, again, a little unusual for the Gospels. But Matthew's account that we're going to look at this morning is the only one that includes the story of Peter asking to come and join Jesus on the water. So that's why we're going to focus on Matthew 14. But before we get there, I just want to kind of talk a little bit about Galilee and the area that we're going to where all of this occurred. Now, I've said this, you may remember me saying this or not, but when we went through on Wednesday night, we spent many months going through the book of Acts. And I talked about when we went through Acts, how when you study Acts and then you go look at many of the letters, the epistles, many of them you can fit into the narrative of the book of Acts, because many of them were written during the time in which things were happening in Acts. And I described it as kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. Okay? Well, the Gospels are kind of like a jigsaw puzzle as well. Because, again, they're covering many of the same things and they're providing different details. And I find it interesting how they fit together. Now, unfortunately, this morning, we don't have time to spend, 2 hours talking about how all the different accounts of the feeding of the 5,000 and the Jesus walking in the water, how they all fit together. But I encourage you in your personal study time, I've given you on the handout at the bottom of the feeding of the 5,000, I've got the parallel passages from Mark 6, Luke 9, John 6. And then at the top of the walking on the water, I've given you the parallels of Mark 6 and John 6. I encourage you in your personal study time, go read those accounts, okay? But when you do, you're going to see some details that we're not going to have time to go over this morning. For example, you're going to see a bunch of places listed that we don't have time to really go through all those places. I've got on here kind of a 3D topographical map of the Sea of Galilee, and in I believe it's in Luke's account, he mentions that they are, the feeding of the 5,000 is near the city or the town of Bethsaida. That is in the northeastern corner of the Sea of Galilee, but the area just south of that was known as the Plain of Bethsaida, which is where most scholars think the feeding of the 5,000 occurred, on that plain. You're going to talk about this morning how I think it's John that says they went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. The other side would have been the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. Okay, so when we read about Bethsaida or the plain, you know, we don't read about the Plain of Bethsaida, but most likely the feeding of the 5,000 occurred in this area. Again, when you're reading the various accounts, you'll read about Gennesaret. Okay, Gennesaret also refers to both a town and a plain. So you've got the town of Gennesaret, which is in the northwest corner, the Plain of Gennesaret, which is also in the northwest corner, and in one of the accounts you'll read about the city of Capernaum. Now, Capernaum is on the edge of the Plain of Gennesaret, so it can be confusing, okay, because you have a town and a plain, and a town and a plain, but that's how they all fit together, okay? So when you're reading going, well, you know, Luke says they were in Bethsaida, and John says they were on the other side, and John says they went to Capernaum, but Mark says they went to Gennesaret. They have to contradict each other. No, they don't, because things were known by different names. And so, like, for example, Capernaum was on the edge of the Plain of Gennesaret. So when one says they went to Gennesaret and one says they went to Capernaum, it could be talking about the same thing. You see what I'm talking about? We don't have time to go through all those details, but I just want you to be aware of that. But where we're at this morning, the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on the water begins on the other side, which is probably in this area where it says the Plain of Bethsaida. Now, this is a picture of the Sea of Galilee. By the way, if you weren't in our Holy Land class, spend a little time talking about this, but the Sea of Galilee is not a sea. It's not an ocean. It's a lake, and not even a particularly big lake, okay? But it's a lake. And this is a picture taken at sunrise from the city of Tiberias, looking toward the east. And so you can see all the way across, because it's not that large. And you can see the mountains on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. We're going to read this morning about how Jesus went up into the mountain. Okay, there's mountains all along the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. This is a picture from the shore just outside of Capernaum. So this is, you know, the area where they ultimately ended up at. This is roughly the area where I was talking about the Plain of Bethsaida, the other side of the Sea of Galilee. This is actually taken from a boat on the Sea of Galilee. You see all kinds of boats of tourists floating on the Sea of Galilee. This is the area where on that previous map we had the Plain of Gennesaret. This is the cliff of Arabel, and then I've got a view from Arabel, which you can see the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, which this is where the ministry of Jesus occurred. I think we looked at this one last week. I've had the opportunity a couple times to be in a boat on the Sea of Galilee, and it hit me this morning when Jeff was leading us in Love Lifted Me. We sang the song Love Lifted Me while floating in a boat on the Sea of Galilee. And it's a pretty surreal experience to be there and to go, this is where Jesus walked on the water. This is where he calmed the sea. Twice calmed the sea. This is where we had the miraculous catch of fish. You know, it's just these incredible things that happen. Nothing traditional about the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is the Sea of Galilee. We know that's where it happened. So pretty humbling to be there. We're going to read about them being in a boat. This is an actual first century boat that was uncovered back in the 1980s. I don't think it went on display until the 1990s because it took 10 years to treat it so that it could stand up to the outside air because it had been buried in mud for 2,000 years. But this is, I think it's a 22-foot long boat, but a fishing boat that was discovered from the first century. So when we read about them being in a boat, it likely was a boat like this, made out of wood. Last slide about this, but again, the other side, you've got the town of Bethsaida, the Plain of Bethsaida, Capernaum, plain of Gennesaret. Gennesaret, the town, would have been in this area. So just giving you a sense, we're talking about the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. Okay. All right, enough introduction. Let's get into the study. I got a lot I want to cover in a very, I don't have a lot of time. So I'm going to start in going in verse 22. Okay, and then we're going to come back and reference what happened before as we go through this together. Okay, so in Matthew 14, it says in verse 22, it says, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain. Remember how I pointed out the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, covered in mountains. It says he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. Okay? So, you've got a blank in your handout. That blank is the word sending. Sending, meaning that he sent the apostles, the disciples, the 12, he sent them away in a boat. Okay, so they were on the other side, probably the plain of Bethsaida. He sent them away. Now, there's a couple of things that I want us to take away from this very simple description of him sending them away. Because it tells us that he sent them away and he went up into the mountains by himself to pray. Now, Jesus and the disciples had originally ended up on the other side of the Sea of Galilee because Jesus wanted to be alone. Okay? If you go back to Matthew 14, earlier Matthew 14 to verse 13, it says, when Jesus heard this. Now, what is that? Well, if you go back before that, I don't have enough handout space to keep put all the text on there. But before that, Matthew and Mark tell us that Jesus had just learned about the death of John the Baptist. Okay? He had just learned about the death of John the Baptist. And Mark also adds the detail, and I've got this in the margin, that he was so pressed by the crowds that were around him, the people that were wanting to hear him, that it says he had no leisure even to eat. So, what precipitates Jesus wanting to go to the other side and be alone was he had just found out death of a relative and an associate, with the one who had baptized him, and he was overwhelmed. And so now, after the feeding of the 5,000, he wants to go back to being alone. He wants to be alone because that's why he came over there in the first place. And what that reminds me of is that Jesus was human. Even though he was fully God, he allowed himself to become fully human. God's plan was to come here on this earth, to send his son here on this earth, to become one of us, to live a perfect life and then die. Paul tells us in Philippians chapter 2 that he did not hang on to being equal with God. He allowed himself to be poured out into the form of man. And this reminds me that Jesus was human. He had a loss in his life. He was overwhelmed by the circumstances of his life, and he needed to be alone. So never forget that Jesus allowed himself to be human. Now, at the end, after the feeding of the 5,000, which I've got in the text up above that in Matthew 14, after the feeding of the 5,000, which we don't know how many people there were, because that was 5,000 men. So how many were there? We don't know. But a lot of people. And John, I put one verse in there from John's account of the feeding of the 5,000. John gives us some insight into why Jesus then wanted to go back up into the mountain by himself. It says, perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So not only did he have a loss, not only was he overwhelmed, but now he's facing this, the people want me to be an earthly king. And this reminds me that Jesus, the mission of Jesus was not to establish a kingdom here on earth. What did Jesus say before Pilate? When Pilate was questioning, my kingdom is not of this world, right? if it were, my disciples would be fighting for me, right? I'd raise an army and we'd fight and we'd conquer. But no, he gave himself up, right? Because his kingdom was not of this world. And that's the second thing I want you to take away as a reminder, that Jesus did not establish a kingdom here on this earth. The kingdom is from heaven. The kingdom is from heaven. And I think it's very easy, and I see this happen a lot, we confuse the nation with the kingdom. But never forget that Jesus' kingdom is based in heaven. He's based in heaven. And this is a reminder, Jesus was not going to let them make him an earthly king, because he says, my kingdom is not of this world. Matthew, when he refers to the kingdom, always calls it the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom that's based in heaven. And this is a reminder of that, because Jesus sent them away in the boat so that he could go back to being alone, because he was not going to allow them to make him an earthly king. So the next thing, let's go down to verse 24. Verse 24, we just read that he went back up in the mountain. He was alone. It says, but the boat by this time was a long way from land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch, and I've got a little note on the side, the fourth watch was 3 a.m. to 6 a.m., okay? In the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. By the way, if you read Mark's account there, Mark says he intended to pass them by. Like, he intended to keep walking and get to the shore ahead of them, and they get there like, whoa, what happened? He intended to pass them by. But he came to them walking on the sea, but when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified. I mean, that makes sense, right? That they were terrified. You got storm, and you got a person who they think is a ghost walking on the water. The terror makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. And said, it is a ghost. And they cried out in fear. Now listen to this. Immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid. I've already mentioned that he intended to walk by them, but he doesn't. He comes to them. Now, the blank there is the word storm, because they're facing a storm. I mentioned that the Sea of Galilee is not very large, but they're not making a lot of progress because they're rowing into the wind. I have never been on the Sea of Galilee when there was a storm, but I had actually had a guy, an Israeli, show me a video on his phone of what had happened on the Sea of Galilee the week before I was there. In the middle of the summer, when it's normally there's no rain at all, and he said it went from storm, it went from, you know, perfect to storm just like that, and the waves. He showed me a picture or a video of this promenade that's in Tiberias, and the waves were just lashing the promenade. And so this is the kind of storm that comes up, and they're facing, and they're trying to row against this, and they look out there on the water and they see Jesus, and they don't know it's him, and they think it's a ghost. And look at what he says to them. He says, it is I. Now I want to tell you what that literally says. Okay, I don't know if you remember, but we did back at the beginning of when we did the study on the I Am statements of Jesus. We had an introductory lesson on a Wednesday night where I talked about that phrase, I Am. That begins in Exodus chapter 3. When Moses is having a conversation with God through the burning bush. We remember that story, right? And God is telling Moses, I need you to go to Egypt and do this. Well, who do I tell them has sent me? And he says, you tell them I am who I am. Now, that was not the name of God. That was the description of what his name means. His name, he gives this in verse 14. His name is in verse 15, which is Yahweh, which in all of our Bibles it says Lord in small caps. That's Yahweh. Yahweh means Yahweh. Yahweh means he is. But he says, tell them that I am sent you. Okay? His name is he is. He says, you tell them I am sent you. The word that's translated I am is the Hebrew word et yeah, Okay? Yahweh, yeah, I am, He is. All right? When the Jewish translators who translated the Old Testament into Greek, into what would become the Septuagint translation, when they translated that word etya, which means I am, into Greek, they used the Greek word, two words, ego ami. Ego ami, I am. That is what Jesus says to them when he approaches the boat. The translators in most translations translate that into something like it's me or it is I, but what he literally says is, I am. Do not be afraid. That's the same word that at the beginning of all the I am statements. So what he literally says to them is, I am. Do not be afraid. I am. He's reminding them that he is the only uncaused cause. He is the only one who has an infinite existence. He is the only one who is worthy of their faith and our faith. And so there is no reason for them to fear. You catch that? And I don't want to turn this into a metaphor, but where they were afraid of the sea and afraid of a ghost, and they get comfort from this, you know, from him telling them that I am this, you know, infinite force that has always been and always will be. The same thing is true for us, right? That he is the only object that is worthy of our faith, right? He is the only object that is worthy of our faith and the only one we should turn to in the storms of life, right? Again, I fear turning Bible stories into metaphorical things, and I'm not trying to go too far down that road. But as they faced a literal storm, and Jesus says, I am, don't be afraid, can remind us that He is the only worthy object of our faith who can be an anchor for our life. The Hebrew writer, and I've got this referenced on there in Hebrews 6, he's talking about the promise that God made to Abraham, but ultimately says the promise that we have from God can be this anchor. And it's based on Jesus having already gone through into the metaphorically, the Holy of Holies. He's already gone through the curtain and is a forerunner for us. He is the only one who is worthy of our faith and can be an anchor because he doesn't move. He doesn't move. Jesus had said in the Sermon on the Mount, put your treasure where? In heaven. Why? It doesn't move. Can't be affected by the things of this life. And here he comes to them as the I am and says, do not be afraid. Now, the next one, let's go down to verse 28. This is where Peter comes in. Okay? This is where Peter comes in. It says in verse 28, it says, Peter answered, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So Peter's making a request, right? If it's you, command me to come to you on the water. He, meaning Jesus, said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. Now, the word that I have there is the word stepping, as in Peter stepping on the water. We know where this is headed, right? That Peter is going to sink. But before we get there and we chastise Peter for sinking, let's not forget this part. Let's not forget this part. Was Peter maybe a little brash being the one to speak up and ask the question? Maybe. But I know one thing. He had enough faith to get out of the boat. Now, in my sermons and illustrations since I've been here, I use my own hobbies as illustrations a lot. I've talked about running. I've talked about photography. One thing I've never talked about is something that preceded running. When I was, from a time of being a little kid through teenage years, early 20s, my obsession was water skiing. Got a picture of me on the water from many years ago. There was a time in my life where if you had a boat going 32 miles an hour and I had a ski on my leg, I felt like I could do anything on the water. So much so that when I had a little girl who was 3 years old, I even strapped skis on my feet and put her on the front of my skis. And I was like, I can, that's not a dad of the year moment there. But anyway, I was very confident in my abilities to water ski. But no matter how confident, and maybe irrationally confident, I was on water skis, there was never, ever a time in all the many hours and years I spent on the water that I ever thought, if I step out of this boat, that I'm going to stand on this water. Not one time. Not one time. And Peter got out of the boat and he stood on the water. And I'm reminded of two things. And I've got this in the margin. I'm reminded of two things. One is, in the book of James, we've studied that before on a Sunday morning series, but in the very beginning of James, James is talking about finding joy in trials. And he says, if you don't have the wisdom to see it this way, you need to pray and ask God for wisdom. We remember that, right? If you don't have if you can't see the benefit from going through trials, pray that God will give you the wisdom. But then he says, let him ask in faith with no doubting. When I read that phrase, let him ask in faith, what it reminds me of is something Jesus said to these same 12 men. And I've got this referenced also in Mark 11, where in the middle of a larger conversation, but he says, when you pray, believe that you have received it. Past tense. What does that mean? It means when you pray for something, if you really have faith, believe that the answer to that prayer has already been set into motion. You with me? I'm sure I've said this before. If you pray for rain, bring an umbrella, right? Believe that the answer has already been set into motion. What did Peter say? Lord, if it is you, command me to come out on that water. Peter had to have believed that the answer to that request had already been granted, right? And yes, his faith fails, but he had enough faith to get out of the boat. I don't know if I would have had enough faith to get out of the boat, even if I'm staring at Jesus standing there on the water. So never forget that Peter got out of the boat. He got out of the boat. So in this story, Peter is an example not just of one whose faith failed, but one who had enough faith to believe that Jesus had already granted his request. And that's what it means to pray with faith. That's what it means to pray with faith. Yes, he might have been brash, but probably had more faith than I do in most situations, which is should be humbling. But from there we go down to verse 30. But when he saw the wind, don't miss that. He saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? By the way, I mentioned this back in lesson one that I'm using a resource written by John Butler for some of the outline points. Butler had a point there called the scolding of Peter. I don't read this as a scolding. I didn't use that point because I don't. Now, one thing we don't have from Scripture is we don't have tone of voice. But I read this more comforting than I do scolding. Maybe that's not right, but that's the way I read it. I read this more comforting than scolding. But regardless, Peter needed saving. He needed saving because he was sinking on the water. And what happened with Peter is something that can happen, can and does happen to all of us. The circumstances took the focus off the Christ. You know, I don't have this on there, it just popped in my head, but the parable of the sower. right? You had the one that was sown among the weeds, right? And the weeds, as soon as it sprang up, the weeds choked it out. And Jesus says, that's the one who gets entangled in the cares of the world, and it chokes out the word. Peter's focus on Jesus, who he had to have been focused on, because why? He got out of the boat. He got out of the boat. But the circumstances, he saw the wind, and the circumstances took the focus off of Jesus. The same thing can and does happen to us. And fear took the place of faith. Now, Scripture tells us consistently, Old Testament to New Testament, I've got a bunch of references in there, from Joshua, from the Psalms, from the Gospels, from the Epistles. We're not going to go through those this morning, but if you've got time in your personal study, go read those. That God has called us not to fear, but to faith. But in this case, the circumstances that took the focus off of the Christ caused him to take his faith and replace it with fear. He became afraid. And what Jesus is calling all of us to do is to keep the focus on Him and to not fear the future. Not fear what's coming. Why? Because our future is secure, right? Our future is secure. And by the way, when He tells Peter, "Oh, you of little faith," that's not the first time He said that to the disciples. This is actually not the first time He's calmed a storm. We're going to talk about the calming in just a minute. He's calmed a storm on the Sea of Galilee with the apostles. Back in Matthew chapter 8, they were all in a boat together, and where was Jesus? He was asleep. And there's a storm, and they wake him up, and what's the first thing He says? "Oh, you of little faith." Same thing. If Peter's faith was little, where's my faith? Because Peter got out of the boat. Let's go down to the end. Verse 32. When they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Again, second time that Jesus calmed a storm that's recorded. And those in the boat worshipped Him, saying, "Truly, You are the Son of God." Now, the fill in the blank here is serenity, because He calmed the storm. But that's not the climax. That's not the point here. I don't believe that's the takeaway. I think the takeaway here is the confession. Because when they were faced with the undeniable power of Jesus, what was the response? They worshiped, and they said, for the first time, at least in Matthew's gospel, for the first time, they said, "You are the Son of God." Now, next week, Lord willing, I think where I'm going to go next is look at two times that Peter confessed Jesus. But the way I understand the chronology of how things happen, this is the first time that the disciples, those 12 men that He handpicked, referred to Him as the Son of God. They worshiped Him, and they acknowledged Him as the Son of God. Now, much like when Andrew introduced Peter to Jesus and said, "This is the Messiah," I don't think they understood exactly what that meant. But they're getting there, right? They're getting there. And I've got references there in the bottom right. Matthew chapter 3 is where the baptism of Jesus, when God the Father refers to Him as what? "My Son, whom I'm well pleased." I've got a reference there to Matthew 16. We're going to go there, Lord willing, next week, which is Peter's confession. Matthew 26, Jesus is before the high priest after he's been arrested, and He's challenged. "Did you really say that You're the Son of God? Did You really say You're the Son of God?" And then in Matthew 27, multiple references to Jesus as the Son of God, but the one that hits me there, the last one, which is after He died and all those incredible things happen. The dead are raising, the temple curtain's been torn from top to bottom, and you have the centurion, Roman soldier, who says what? "Truly, this was the Son of God." The disciples are now on their journey to understanding what it really meant for Jesus to be the Son of God. When they were faced with this undeniable demonstration of His power, they had seen it over and over and over again. Now they've gotten to the point where they're like, you're the Son of God. There's no other explanation for that. And everybody, all of us, are presented with the same thing. Not through our physical eyes, but through the eyes of faith. And do we have enough faith to recognize the power of Jesus and acknowledge Him as the Son of God? Do we have that much faith? And that's what we're being called to do, is to acknowledge Him as the Son, acknowledge Him as the Savior, and commit to Him. If you're here this morning and you've never committed your life to Jesus, you're faced with that as a decision in view of this incredible being that has rescued us from certain death. We just have to accept it, acknowledge who He is, and follow Him as our new Master. If you're here this morning and you've never made that commitment, and Christ is calling you to make that commitment, if there's anything else we can do for you, please come while we sing an invitation song.